learning how to tell stories about the future is becoming more urgent and necessary. We actually have a great genre of stories about the future called sci-fi, right? But people think of them as this, oh, dystopian fiction. Well, I think it's really interesting to think about how can science fiction inform our understanding of what could happen in a more connected way. Great movies like Her, where it talks about, you know, what is it like to actually build a deep relationship with essentially an AI, or Ex Machina, you know, when we can't tell the difference between a robot and a human and that we develop feelings for them. These are really important because I think we're seeing the shrinking gap between science fiction and science fact. I mean, it's happening.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to episode 5 of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where we talk story. I'm your host, Austin Meyer, a documentary filmmaker and photographer, and I want to thank you for joining me on this journey of learning. This week on the podcast, I'm chatting with Lisa K. Solomon. Lisa does it all. She's a speaker, an author, an educator, focused on helping leaders learn how to be more creative, flexible, and resilient in the face of increasing complexity and change. She's currently a designer in residence at Stanford University's Institute of Design and founding chair of transformational practices in leadership at Singularity University. That's a pretty cool title. Lisa co-authored the Wall Street Journal bestseller Moments of Impact, How to Design Strategic Conversations That Accelerate Change, and more recently, Design a Better Business, New Tools, Skills, and Mindset for Strategy and Innovation. This conversation is sort of split into two sections. In the first half, we take a close look at Lisa's best-selling book, Moments of Impact. Specifically, we talk about the ideas of designing conversations. So what does that mean? How does designing conversations relate to stories? And what are specific strategies that we can use to design conversations? Then in the second half, we talk about the class Lisa is currently teaching at Stanford called Creativity Rules, Inventing the Future. Here we talk about the value of telling stories about the future. So with that, let's jump right into my conversation with Lisa Solomon. Lisa, thanks so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast.
It is really fun to be here.
All Austin. Right. So I like to start by having people say, where are we right now? Because we are in person, which is special. So where are we doing this interview today?
Yeah, it's super exciting. We're doing this interview in Menlo Park, California, mm-hmm. in my home.
In your home. Thanks for having me.
It's really fun to have you here, and specifically in my office, where I get to look at lots of books that have inspired my work over the years and continue to get me excited about what's to come.
Cool. So I think it'd be useful to start maybe by having you describe a little bit about your work as an author, the books that you've written, because I think that will get a nice entry point into what you're excited about these days.
Yeah, absolutely. In the last 5 years, I've co-authored 2 books about the power of design to help leaders imagine new futures. So the first book is called Moments of Impact, and it's about how to design strategic conversations to accelerate change. And this builds off of 15 years of scenario planning work, where my colleagues and I would work with leaders to help them imagine multiple futures, not just an extension of their current future in one direction, but how do they look from the outside in to see signals from trends that are emerging and use that to inform better strategy and decisions for today. And we realized that those strategic conversations about the future were very different than a strategic planning process. Mm-hmm. And it was, in many ways, the most important leadership skill that leaders have never been taught, mm-hmm. to bring people together, to use their diversity of input and experience in order to understand future possibilities and then bring them to life.
Okay.
And so that was really
fun. So what do you mean by future opportunities? Do you mean like, say, I'm the CEO of a company and I want to make this product in the future, or I'm envisioning future technologies like AI and that kind of stuff, or all of the above, or what?
All of the above. I mean, it's at this usually a strategic moment where it's going to have a meaningful impact on the future of the organization, so not where should we have our offsite or where should we do our holiday party, but should we go into China? Mm-hmm. We see the world is digitizing more and more. What does that mean for us? How does that help us think differently about how we connect with customers, whether it means a full business model change from selling a product to, say, selling a service, which is a lot of where organizations are going right now, realizing that it's not, a lot of customers don't want to own assets, but they want access to what those products used to do for them. One of the greatest examples is cars, right? Young buyers are not buying cars. They just want to get from point A to point B, and thanks to the emergence of new companies like Uber and Lyft, they don't have to buy a car.
Right.
So how do you think about that? And so particularly legacy organizations that have been doing the same thing for decades, they're really worried about what does this mean? What does this sort of growing digitization of our world mean for them? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen from a single individual pontificating on his or her own and coming back and saying, I have the answer.
Gotcha.
That happens through conversation. And so that's what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
How do we actually surface those kinds of conversations that get people on board with the change that needs to happen?
So before I ask about how you might see storytelling play into having those conversations, I'm curious, what was like a moment when you realized, wow, people need help? People need to learn this skill better.
Yeah.
When did you learn?
It's such a great question. We didn't set out to write the book, and that's my co-author Chris Ertel and I, who together we worked at a firm called Global Business Network, which was really the epicenter of this practice called scenario planning. It started by Stuart Brand, a great storyteller who started the Whole Earth Catalog, among many, many other things. Peter Schwartz, another great storyteller. I had invited Chris to do a seminar over at Stanford with our colleague named Chuck Howes, who was running MediaX at the time, which is this interdisciplinary institute helping leaders prepare for different futures. And he was running something on the future of conversation. And I sort of joked with Chuck at the time, and I said, Chuck, that's so funny because I don't think people know how to have conversations anymore. Mm-hmm. Right now we're just sort of texting each other and we're emailing each other, but we're not really having deep, meaningful conversations about important topics. And he looked at me and he said, that's so interesting, Lisa. I agree with you. Why don't you run a workshop on that for me in our upcoming gathering? And I said, me? He said, yeah. So I invited Chris to join me because I knew he cared deeply about the practice of having these kinds of generative conversations. And I said, let's do this. It'll be fun. So we did the workshop for 3 hours. I thought it was an idea put to bed. And then Chris called me a month later and he said, you know, Lisa, I'm looking at my bookshelf and I see lots of books on design and lots of books on conversation and lots of books on strategy, but zero books on how to actually design a strategic conversation. So let's do it. And so that was the moment that set us off on a journey to publish this book. And in that, we had the opportunity to interview over 100 different experts in various fields, many of whom we would call black belt designers of conversations. And they didn't know that they were black belts and designers of conversations. They just knew if they had a conversation that was based on PowerPoint presentations and facts and figures that they would never accelerate the change that needed to happen.
Mm.
So it was really about dissecting their craft.
So it sounds like you almost have, when we're thinking about story, you are here in that moment about to write your first book, which I imagine, to me that'd be very intimidating, right? So you're writing a story and kind of figuring out that process as you go. And then also story, you're also talking about story.
Yes.
A lot in the book. So first, let's go from your perspective. What was it like to write your first book?
Humbling.
Really?
It is. I mean, and we very much wanted it to be a book about stories. And it starts off with a story. And throughout, we were hungry for those stories that we thought needed to be told. Because if you think about what makes for a great conversation and where you go to learn about it, it's hard to figure out where to go. I mean, now we know what a great presentation looks like because you can watch the TED channel or any of the videos of someone up on stage and you can dissect what makes for a compelling presentation. But what makes for a compelling conversation, they're often very private. And the more important they are, the more private that they are. So that was a hunt for these stories that people were willing to tell that we thought would be interesting.
And how did you go about doing it?
Well, we just started with a really long list of just anecdotes that we had heard along the way. One of my favorite stories about finding good stories is I was standing in line many years ago. We had just started to write the book, and I was at this conference called The Intersection. So I figured, well, that's interesting. It was actually held at Pixar, and I wanted to go and see Pixar more than anything.
Yeah.
So I'm standing in this long lunch line, And I start talking to the person in front of me, and I said, "Oh, hi. You know, who are you, and what do you do?" And I'm Lisa, and I'm here because I'm interested in new ideas and innovation, creativity. And he said, "Oh, well, I'm an entrepreneur, and I started this baby food company, and I was the head of innovation at Clif Bars." And we started to talk, and it turned out that he shared this incredible story with me about how he had just convened a board meeting to talk about the growth of his organization. And instead of doing it the traditional way that entrepreneurs convene their board and present facts and figures, he invited them to participate in what he called a baby food fight. Hmm. And he assigned each one of the board members to play the role of one of their main competitors, and then to take an hour outside of the boardroom to go and research how, as say the head of Gerber Foods or their head of Happy Baby, they would devise a strategy to come back and kill his company called Plum Organics. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. You don't typically hear about board meetings where people are playing role-playing games that are simulations that actually ask board members to go out and do research. It was so interesting. We sat down, we talked for an hour, and his story is now page 3 of our book. So I love that. I think to me there's lots of things to unpack there. One is the willingness to have conversations with people in unexpected places. The second part is to be curious, you know, to ask questions and to be really interested in what their lives are like and what they're working on and what interests them. And then the third is to follow up and to say, hey, would you be willing to share that with others? I think others would really learn from that experience.
Did you get any pushback because of the private nature of some of the conversations that you were trying to deconstruct and talk about?
We definitely did. I mean, throughout the book, there's a few dozen stories. Some of them are masked, you know, one multinational corporation.
Right.
But the thing about story, I think, is that the more specific you can make it, the more powerful it is. When you're able to assign a name, when you're able to paint a vivid picture of where it is, when you're able to highlight the urgency of why that story was so important at that moment, it becomes that much more powerful. So we really tried to get people to be okay with sharing their story up front and to be willing to share those details. And I think once we were able to offer the opportunity for people to tell their stories through the lens of it helping other people, it loosened them up. You know, it wasn't about prying open the proprietary details of what they were going through, but rather to say, look, we think others can learn from you. Would you be willing to share it?
So that's the way you framed, like when you were trying to present them why it's good for them to talk to you about private conversations.
Yes.
That's how you framed it.
Yes. Okay, and we also wanted to shed a light on a lot of the choices that they were making that often went invisible. I mean, we kind of take conversations for granted, and we're very quick to sort of acknowledge what a terrible meeting is because we are so bored and we feel like our time is wasted. But it's not often where we come out and say, wow, that was a great conversation. And what happened? Right? So it was a chance for people who were having some success in these invisible ways to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And so that was also a deep philosophy of the book, was to approach it through the lens of generosity.
Nice. So again, on your process of writing your first book here, what other challenges were you facing?
Oh.
Like, what was something that you're like, when you came back to write your second book, you were thinking, oh, thankfully I have this lesson from the first one. What was another thing that like...
Well, certainly a big part of the first one was what you think is going to happen is not going to happen. So we wrote a very thoughtful outline of the book for the first one, as an example, and the chapter structure, and we actually wrote a sample chapter to get people interested, publishers interested in buying it. And we had a fantastic acquiring editor who was excited about the project. And the moment we signed, we went to meet her in New York, and she took our first outline of the chapter structure and basically ripped it up. We said,
really?
Yeah. And we said, oh. She said, yeah, the idea is great, but this is not going to work. And so we, again, from a standpoint of wanting to write something that had utility to the people that bought it, you could say that the whole book we were trying to write as a compelling toolbox and story, right? We wanted to get the audience involved from the very beginning. And so we had to take her expertise to say, look, you need to rethink your structure on this. So from the very beginning, you know, I think we had great humility that this was going to be our own discovery process of trying to figure out what would be useful to our readers.
So I'm curious to hear more about that. So the structure of your book,
as you first presented it, did not provide the value or utility to the readers, which the eventual book ended up doing. So what had to change for you to offer more value to the readers?
So in the first book, I think we had a field book in the middle of the book. We wanted to make it super, super useful. And we know that people are time-starved these days. And so we always knew we wanted to create a kind of Cliff Notes version of the book, right? So, okay, if you do nothing else, just jump to the Cliff Notes and, you know, ask this, do this, read this, try this. And initially we had thought that would be in the middle of the book, and she thought that that would be confusing. So that was one thing. She put it towards the end of the book. She also just thought that the overall structure of how we were laying the chapters needed to change. And so that was more organic. And we also knew that as we did our interviews, some of that would also come to bear as well. So we had to approach it with clarity about what we wanted to achieve at the end, but a willingness to change the path along the way.
Gotcha.
And it definitely evolved. And you know, throughout the own process, we would have these moments of sort of this, our own moment of impact in the middle. Like, yes, that's a great story. We didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And moments where we, had to, kill something that we thought was great. Like, it just doesn't fit.
Right. And what do you hope that people who read that book took away from it? What are some of the key takeaways?
I think number one, that these conversations can be designed. That just because
difficult conversations
about the unknown, conversations about the future, that you can actually have a lot more agency in ensuring a better outcome than you realize. That having a conversation is a lot more than just, let me reserve this time on your calendar and hope that and write a carefully tight agenda, and hope that the facilitation magic will do its part. And a big premise of the book is actually you can design a whole lot more ahead of time. And if you think of a conversation as something that in many ways has a narrative arc, much like a great story, a beginning and a middle and an end, and you ask yourself, where do we want to end? Not at a specific answer, but as much about an advancement of understanding or a connection that we have with someone else on an emotional level. How do we want to end? Do we want people to leave excited? Do we want them to leave nervous? Do we want them to leave motivated? Mm-hmm. And if we have clarity about where we want them to end at the end of the conversation, then what are the choices we would make in order to help get them there? Mm-hmm. So the fact that that's teachable and knowable is super exciting.
Can we use an example that maybe grounds that in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, absolutely. So my favorite cases in the book is with Toyota Financial Services.
Okay.
And they, like many organizations, were starting to feel some heat about competition coming in through Ubers and Zipcars and Lyfts of the world. They were feeling nervous that people were not buying cars anymore. They were feeling pressure from Japan, their mothership, to go and sell more cars. And the CEO said, look, we've got to become disruptive. We've got to become innovative. And the top 60 people, leaders in the organization, didn't really know what that meant. And so we worked with them to design what was really a two-day conversation to land at a place that was not the answer going forward, but to get alignment that all of the executives needed to come together and make investments that would really help them on their path towards getting closer to these growth goals. And so it was as much about getting people invested in doing the hard work, that innovation and ideas were not just going to happen in one session, but as the CEO said, this was probably the most powerful moment of all when we were closing up this meeting where we explored new business models, we explored competitive trends, we told stories throughout, and the CEO got up there at the very end and he said, you may think that you're going back to your day job on Monday and all of this is going to go away. Let me be very clear. This is your day job. This is what you have to do. And so that like call to action, that sort of emotional and clear mandate that said all of this hard work of imagining a new future of what's going to get to our goals is what you must be focused on. So a lot of the design of the conversation was raising the urgency that this was not some like fun brainstorming exercise that would be forgotten when you go back to your office.
So I heard strategies for designing conversations. Specifically, I've heard start with, or maybe not start, you can tell me, with the end.
Yes, design like backwards.
Design backwards. So design backwards.
Yep.
I'm going to write that down.
And to be specific on that, Austin, what I say is, hey, imagine you're at an all-day meeting and it ends at 5. And it's 5:05 and you're driving home and you're calling a friend or a colleague outside of the organization or your partner and you're telling them about what happened. Mm-hmm. What are you saying? So that's usually the starting place. Mm-hmm. What are you saying on your ride home?
Gotcha. What are some other tactics? Design backwards. And I'm going to try afterwards you say this to kind of think about how it relates to the films that I make.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes I feel like when I'm telling stories, I don't do that.
Well, it's hard to do because you're discovering it along the way.
You're discovering it along the way, right.
But I imagine it is similar in the fact that when viewers leave your movies, you probably have a point of view about what you want them to feel.
Definitely.
What you want them to know. A documentary is a certain kind of story form.
Yep.
And doesn't have to be boring just mm-hmm. because it's about facts. Mm-hmm. Right? There's, you know, and that's the craft.
Yeah.
How do you figure out how to bring emotion into it? And the thing that's so exciting about this book and this craft around designing conversations is that we've been taught for so long that important conversations need to be serious. Okay. Mm. And then people then extract that to say, well, then therefore they need to be without emotion, right? We need to be professional about this. And I would say emotion is where the data is. When you're excited about something and you feel like, wow, I really think there's potential here, there's useful data there.
Yeah.
And equally important, when you're nervous about something, there's useful data there. But we're sort of taught to leave that outside. This is the boardroom. Austin,
yeah.
We got to be
no
serious
emotion.
About this.
Right.
And I think that's the exact wrong stance.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying we need a brawl in the middle of the boardroom.
Right.
But spirited debate is really useful. And if we allow ourselves to show emotion and we have the facility to say, hey, I see you're upset about that. Can you share more? Or I see you're having a reaction to that that's stronger than I expected. Why is that? Mm-hmm. That's where the juicy stuff is.
Totally.
But we're not really taught how to do that.
Yeah. And that's one of the lessons that I had to learn in journalism school. I remember I was doing an interview with he wrote pieces for ESPN.com and he did beautiful features. His name is escaping me right now, which is embarrassing. But anyway, I did like a profile on him, how he tells stories. And one of the key characteristics in the features that he writes is he often talks about how the characters, individuals that he's writing about, their relationships with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from doing the research before my interview with him that his father had passed away, and that was like a really impactful experience that he'd written about some before. And in my interview, I was nervous to really go after the emotion. Like, I was nervous that I would make him upset if I asked him about the influence that his late father had had on the stories that he does. And he could, and this is over the phone, he could tell that I was nervous to ask the question. And he's like, hey kid, let me just stop you right there, straight up. And he's like, ask the question you wanna ask. Like, don't pull punches.
Right.
You know?
Right. They feel it.
You're
skirting around. You're not really revealing anything about yourself, which then makes it perhaps uncomfortable for them to reveal something.
Right. So that was a big learning moment for me to not shy away from those powerful emotions. And now, I mean, I try to let those inform all the stories I'm telling. And I've been really interested lately in doing kind of these Humans of New York style portraits mm-hmm. where I go up to strangers on the streets and do interviews. And I actually give myself the challenge. My goal in those interviews is how fast can I get someone to reveal something emotional and unique from their life? Mm-hmm. What one question can I ask and let them go on with their day? And like, that's a really interesting challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, it suggests that you have to get them feeling comfortable enough so that they're willing to share that
yeah.
without it feeling gimmicky mm-hmm. or superficial, because mm-hmm. also people can read into that.
But then how do you do that in like in the context we're talking about with businesses?
Absolutely.
And there's so much like politics, there's so much, I don't want to make my boss upset, you know, like how do you create emotional safety so that you can be real about emotions?
It's such a great question. And that's, again, why it's a craft, right? No situation is going to be exactly alike. And we talk about five different principles in the book to actually help you get to that. And
okay.
One of them that I find to be so fascinating and often overlooked is what is the physical environment that you're in? Because that matters, right? Or if you are in a position of feeling relaxed, at ease, you're going to be more generative and open to sharing more than if you're in, again, the traditional place we go is the boardroom. When I say boardroom, what does that conjure up to you?
Let me answer.
Yeah.
If you say boardroom, what that conjures up for me is like that I'm going to be quietly listening to the boss talk at me.
Yes.
That's what I think of.
Right. In a room that is dark, windowless.
Yeah, that probably doesn't get used at any other time.
No. A big, handsome table of oak.
Yeah. Yeah.
With like
table,
big leather chairs where you're kind of sitting back in your posture, sinking in, ready to be talked at.
Yep. Dark leather. Yes.
Can you imagine a worse place for people to be creative, for people to be generative? So that's one of the things we say. Get out of that room. Create a different room. One of the reasons, for example, why innovation processes like Agile have stand-up meetings is to literally stand up.
What is Agile again?
So Agile is a process where you are releasing new ideas in a very, very fast clip, right?
Okay.
So rather than waiting to release a new product that gets perfected over many months and then you put it out into the wild, you're actually trying to make advancements on the idea every day.
Okay.
And a big part of the Agile process is when people come together to review how they're doing. And they do that in a stand-up meeting often for a certain amount of time, 5 to 10 minutes, no more than that, because they want to architect conditions of urgency of sharing the most pertinent information, right? That's just one example of designing the space in order to deliver the utility of what that meeting is about. Just one very specific example. We know from our time at Stanford together that at the Stanford Institute for Design, a lot of the furniture there is on wheels. Why? So that they can be modular and you can move things around to get people in a different physical stance.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of places to put ideas up on whiteboards because once you visualize an idea, it changes the nature of the idea and your relationship to that idea to promote collaboration. Mm-hmm. So these are just all examples of design choices you can make in order to create different conditions in the environment.
Space, yeah.
Another thing that we do, which I think is particularly relevant to story that we suggest in the book, is to start off with an emotional vehicle of some kind, a video, or bring in a person that's been affected by the issue and have them tell their personal narrative, right? So the initial setting of the conversation gets framed through the lens of a personal or human experience. Mm. That's another very powerful way to get people in a different stance.
Gotcha.
So I think there's lots of things you can do to kind of signal to your participants that emotion is welcome here.
Mm, that's nice. And one of the learnings that I take about that for my craft, I mean, when you're talking about like designing conversations literally could be placed with designing stories.
Absolutely.
It's one the same. And I think that's such a valuable learning for me because often I'm doing interviews in my films, right? And even where we're doing an interview right now, you know, I probably could have thought more about that because the space we choose will elicit different information and different emotion for you.
Absolutely.
So right now, I guess we are sitting in your office. So that's actually not a bad spot because it's probably where you are doing a lot of this deep thinking about the books you're writing, about the concepts you're teaching. And it makes me think about if I do an interview, you know, with someone who's in one of my films, what is the environment that I place that person in that allows me the tools that I need to capture the best audio, to capture the best video, but also puts them into an emotional state that is, that, I don't know if whether it's like what I want them to be in the, the emotional state, or like what I, as the storyteller, as that is my profession, that's what I do, whatever I feel the emotion is that I think the story is really about. I don't know. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, well, again, I think it's part of the craft of telling a great story. It's also part of the craft of facilitating a great conversation, right? You want to get people in a place where they're willing to be honest and authentic and share what's on their mind in a way that they feel represents their point of view, where they're not going to get penalized or judged or criticized for it. And it also has to serve a larger purpose.
Yeah.
So imagine in your story, you want to get what's honestly on somebody's mind as they're doing their interview. And you hope that there will be something of utility that will fit to that larger narrative arc that you're building over time.
Right.
Right. But you can't force them to say it, because then you're giving them a script. Then it's not a documentary.
Yeah.
Then it's a totally
different kind of story. And the inherent filming of a documentary is if you change the environment. You have a camera in front of someone's face, which immediately changes their behavior.
Absolutely.
And that's why I've gotten so many of the best results in my work, like when I spend a lot of time with someone, even before I start filming, to just build up that comfort. So
right. And why is that, right? You're building trust, you're building connection. What I try to do as a facilitator and designer of conversations and of stories is I try to learn from other great storytellers and other great interviewers. So many people know I love watching Oprah for that reason, is because she would develop this great rapport with her guests on her show that was in service of allowing the guest to share his or her stories, to allow the audience to learn something from it, that would allow all the viewers to learn something from it. Mm-hmm. And she was very true to her brand of live your best life. Mm-hmm. And that's a craft, right? And so because Oprah developed a global brand around her style, I imagine she'd have to spend days and days and days, right, that you could trust that Oprah would have your back. She wasn't going after the gotcha or the gimme or something to cheat to get to that authentic response.
Yeah.
Same with now. I love to watch Stephen Colbert. He is a genius interviewer, and he is incredible around connecting with his audience to build rapport with them, both physically in the audience as well as all of his viewers, in the way that he blends the information of the day through humor and even his physicality of how he embodies it. And so I think it's so interesting about how everyone approaches their own craft, to be authentic, to making connections with others in order to share information that has an impact beyond just knowing more figures or facts.
Mm-hmm. So what were those five key strategies? So you have said designing backwards, was that one? Or was that not one of the five?
Well, I mean, I think that's a general principle.
That's a general principle.
The five key principles we talk about in the book.
Yeah.
And each one are supported by specific practices. So
yeah,
we can go into some of those. But number one, when you're designing a conversation, you need to know why, right? What is your purpose of having that conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Is it about building understanding? Like the example I shared with you earlier with Toyota Financial Services, right? Why do we even need to innovate, as an example?
Yeah.
Or is it about shaping options? So now we know we need to innovate. What are the range of possibilities we could choose? Or is it about making decisions? Okay, we know we need to innovate. We've looked at these options, so let's go forward. How are we going to do it? Most people think they're doing all three in a conversation. It's hard to do all three, right? So the first principle is to find your purpose. Why are you even coming together? Mm-hmm. That may sound silly and simple. That's actually one of the things that's overlooked most. Like I said, people just need to, hey, we have a problem. Let's get together and solve it. So slowing down to figure out what it is that you have to do. The second key principle is engaging multiple perspectives. So instead of having the same people that were at the last meeting, ask yourself, who's affected by this challenge? How could we learn more about this challenge from different kinds of people? Do we need experts? Do we need customers? Do we need competitors? Do we need suppliers? How do we make sure that we are not getting blindsided by not having all the information? Mm-hmm. And how do we create the conditions to allow people to feel safe in order to show up?
Yeah.
So that's the second one. The third is, how do we frame it? So what's the question we're asking? And I imagine, again, as a documentary filmmaker, you're often thinking about what is it that I'm going after here? Why is this interesting? What is the angle? And we know
you
can frame things from a, you know, a really big perspective. You can frame things from a super micro perspective, or you can try to find something in the middle.
Yeah.
That's an art in and of itself.
When I was in Zambia earlier this year, and I was doing a documentary on infant and maternal health, I ended up following two women who were about the same point in their pregnancy, and I wanted to follow them through delivery. So I arrive in a village. You know, I have worked with the local health clinic to identify about 10 women who were coming there due to deliver in the time period that I was looking at. And now I have 10 people. And it's like, which one do I choose?
Wow.
That is the framing of my story. And it's like, do I go with the person who is in the worst circumstances that might not be illustrative of the whole, but might be the most emotional, wild story? Do I go with the one that is most illustrative of the whole? Or, you know what I'm saying? And then it's just like, oh, it's like such a trip.
It's so hard. And I will admit, Austin, that was the hardest chapter for us to write, the framing, because it is so subjective. It's so subjective. And so when you're in service of, let's say, your audience, of who's watching, or the people that are going to ultimately be affected by the conversation that you're designing for, you need to have that sense of service to them to help inform your choices. And that's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Framing.
So,
cool.
So that's a really, really tricky lifelong craft. And I think it's so important now in this world where we're just getting completely distracted by all these, you know, pings of information, the tweets that we're getting that's taking us in all these different directions. We forget to pause and say, the context, where is this coming from? Who has framed this for us? Mm. So that's an important one. The fourth one is, we already talked about the importance of environment.
Yep.
So how do you set the scene?
Love that.
And the last one, which is really relevant to story, is called make it an experience. So how do we think about engaging not just the head, but the heart and spirit? And that's very much connected to the power of story.
And what do you mean by heart and spirit?
Well, again, I think when we can get people emotionally connected to the challenge that they're working on, it could really, really make a huge difference. The baby food fight was a fun one that I shared earlier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we have stories in the book where my co-author Chris has worked with a monastery in Australia that was dying out because they were literally not able to marry as part of their faith, and therefore there were less people coming into the religion. And he played a demography game to help show the principals of this monastery that in the next 50 years, how drastically their population would shrink, because they were keeping the conversation at such a sort of removed, objective level that they weren't in it, they weren't feeling it. Mm-hmm. And that was a devastating and risky thing to do, was to get them to live and step into a future that was drastically different and really declining in extraordinary ways. And that urgency that he was able to architect got them to make some very different choices on the other side. Mm. So I think we need to play around with allowing our emotional selves to be a part of the conversation. I think this is so important, even more now with the advent of all the technology, you know, that's taking off faster and faster. And we're starting to see examples of what happens when we don't allow ourselves to think through the human consequences of some of these scaling technologies ahead of time, right? So I, you know, we could take a look at Facebook, right? And started off as, well, this is a great way to just connect people, you know, from all around the world and have
right.
them share stories about themselves. And, you know, did they think of the consequences of what would happen when those then personal details would be revealed, you know, in unexpected ways, right? So how do we raise the urgency of the decisions we're making now, not just from in the business context, how it might lead to more growth, but, you know, is it the moral thing to do? Is it the ethical thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the human thing to do?
Yeah.
And therefore, should we do it, yes or no?
So just to review for the listeners around designing impactful conversations, moments of impact, we have the five lessons that Lisa and her co-author revealed. We have the start with the why, engage multiple perspectives. Chime in here if I miss anything. the importance of framing the context of the conversation, to set up space and environment based on the outcome that you're looking for, based on your why, and then to make it an experience to engage the heart and the soul, I believe was your language.
That's fantastic, Austin. That was like the cliff notes of the cliff notes. You don't have to go to the cliff notes. They are.
Okay, so based on those lessons, you also are an amazing educator and speaker, you're amazing at everything.
Thank you. I'll put you on my speed dial for that.
There you go. I'm wondering, I know you're teaching a class at Stanford right now, so maybe you could talk a little bit about what are you teaching these days, and then maybe how you think about some of those five elements when you're crafting the experience
Absolutely.
And story of this class.
Absolutely. And I'll even start there. I mean, it was a revelation to me after we wrote the book, Moments of Impact, that we could have substituted learning experiences for conversations, right? So the subtitle is How to Design Strategic Conversations to Accelerate Change. We could have easily said How to Design Learning Experiences that Accelerate Embodiment of Agency, right? A productive agency of experiential learning in ways that transforms how we think about ourselves and what's possible. And I do a lot of work in K-12 education, trying to help reform a system that's focused on teaching knowable answers to getting students ready to go into an unknowable world. And it's very much informing the class that I'm teaching this fall at Stanford with an incredible colleague, Tina Seelig, who is a wonderful author and innovation professor who puts out great work to the world. And our class is called Inventing the Future. And we have 35 undergrads. And every week we introduce them to practices of creativity and practices around futures and foresight. And then we have them work in small student teams to create a future, a 50-year future, on an emerging technology like drones or autonomous vehicles that are smarter than us or printing organs. And we have them debate the 50-year utopian future or the 50-year dystopian future. Mm. And to see how we can learn from the stories that they develop from applying these practices to these worlds. And it's been fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And in many ways, every week is, you know, a series of stories, not just one story, but, you know, we force them or encourage them to imagine a multiplicity of stories. And one of my favorite parts about the class is that at the end of these debates, these 8-minute debates, instead of saying, why are they wrong, we say, what did you learn from the other story? What did you learn from them that surprised you? So it's a real generative experience for everybody. And then the last part that's really exciting is that we often bring in an expert in the field to then comment on what they heard from the students who have just 1 week to work on it. They don't learn about the topic until the week before. And we give the students a chance to ask the expert questions. So it's been wonderfully engaging for everybody because we walk out feeling energized and knowing a lot more about both the topic and an approach to take to bring it to life.
So what is the role of storytelling in that class?
Storytelling is key. It's interesting when you see not just students, but nearly anyone over the age of about 10 to try to think about the future, they're really anchored in what they know in the present. And so getting them to be comfortable imagining the unimaginable and then communicating that is really a learned process. And story is absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that every week in this class, Inventing the Future, there's a small group of students, 4 to 5, that give an 8-minute vision of the future that's either utopian or dystopian through story. Mm-hmm. And so not only do they have to go out and quickly become not expert, but at least knowledgeable about the topic, whether it's vehicles that are smarter than us or extreme colonization of space or lab-grown meat was another topic. So they have to get some baseline facts. But then they need to tell a narrative to the class in a way that gets them into that future with them. So last week we had a debate on the future of lab-grown meat, and the two different groups took wildly different approaches to the story. One imagined a company 50 years in the future, that they were at a board meeting, and they told different sides of the debate around why lab-grown meat was good for the world through the lens of the different officers or leaders that would be reporting in the story. So one was the chief sustainability officer, and they were talking about why lab-grown meat has been better for the environment. And one was the chief marketing officer, and they talked about how exciting it was that this really big football school now has a tailgate sponsored by lab-grown meat and what that means. So they used that as the vehicle for painting this picture of the future, because we can imagine what a board meeting is today, and now they were just taking us there in the future. The other took a different role play of attending a UN meeting in the future, mandating that we bring back livestock. That lab-grown meat had just decimated the cattle population, and how devastating that was for the world, and why it was critical that we created a resolution to support the cultivation of cattle again. And I just love that they both used different framing devices to get us into the story of these futures so that we could be there with them to learn about everything that they had learned. So story is critical.
And what do you think that adds to the conversation, or what kind of value do you think that presents to an audience or to the learners in this class to do this role play, to imagine the story rather than just sitting down and having a debate about, like,
is this good or bad?
Is this good or bad?
Yeah, right, absolutely. One is it makes it more concrete, and that's absolutely critical, because these words are just fuzzy words. AI, blockchain, artificial meat. What do those mean, really, in the context of our world? It's hard to be concrete about it, and it's hard to put a context around it. So it's really helpful from that standpoint, because the people listening to the stories haven't done the research. So they're hearing this for the first time. So it makes it concrete, and then related to that, it makes it relatable. Oh, I can imagine that world. Oh, I can now imagine, well, what happens when we don't have restaurants that serve meat anymore? What does that mean? And oh, I can imagine that that might create a world in which those that have access to the designed meat that will give them all the nutrients they need to be super successful and focused will be a privileged elite class versus those that are now getting the equivalent of spam, you know, from a lab. So it makes it relatable, and now they're in the story. And so I think that's really important for them. And the other, it makes it more memorable. I mean, listen, we're just bombarded with information. So instead of giving a whole bunch of facts and figures about how many venture capitalists are now supporting artificial meat around the world, now they'll forget that, but they'll remember this story. So I think for those three reasons, it's really powerful.
And you mentioned that you're also teaching creativity practices. What are some of the things that you find are really opening up your students' minds to allow them to be more creative and create these types of stories?
Absolutely. So this is Tina's real genius. So she has all these methods to help students reframe what they know into creative practices. So we've done exercises like assumption testing, where we'll take a look, for example, at a circus, and we'll take a look at an old video of a Barnum and Bailey's opening act, and we'll say, what are all the things we say about a circus? And we list all of the adjectives, and then she'll prompt to say, well, what if it was the opposite? What could the opposite be? And so to reimagine, and then we'll apply that towards other instances, like the DMV. What do you know about the DMV? What could be the opposite? And those are very easy techniques that you can get into a different frame of mind about what could be. So we've done practices like that. We've also done something more related to both creativity and thinking about the future, where you start with an existing trend. And let's say, you know, the creation of cryptocurrencies. And then you build out from there what's the first implication of that? Well, you'll have, you know, maybe black market or exchanges that are not regulated in the same way. Okay, then what's the implication for that? And then what's the implication for that? So you take it out to the second, the third, and the fourth order implication. All of a sudden you're getting wildly different possibilities that you can then build out into a story. So we expose them to these practices, and then we blend them together. And in that class in particular, where we started with what's called the futures implication wheel, where you start with an existing trend and then you go to more and more unknowable elements. We then applied the story spine on top of that, which is another practice that I think you know well.
Yeah, I taught that yesterday.
And that was so powerful, where you take one in this fourth order implication and then you turn it into a story, right? And so that just, it gives them a sense of how powerful it is to use these as practices to then become both imaginers of better futures and influential communicators of those future versus saying, okay, here's a blank slate. What's going to happen? So it's really exciting to see their development. We've been very lucky. The students have been fantastic and they come to see us in office hours and we routinely hear, this class is changing the way I think. This class is changing the way I take in information. This class is changing my view of what's possible.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
This is an interesting conversation to me because for a lot of reasons, but I think usually when I'm thinking of story and when I'm consuming stories, either reading, watching, or listening, I'm often taking in stories that are about either the present or about the past. Mm-hmm. It's like I haven't really thought about stories of the future that much. That's why this is like, it's kind of like a challenge to wrap my mind around it some. But I just think about, you know, we're sitting here in California where our sky is blanketed in smoke and we have people out there who are trying to raise awareness about climate change. What is going to happen in the future? And that's what I'm thinking about. This conversation is making me think about this. Like, you know, how can we tell stories that will allow us to avoid the apocalypse in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, I think you're talking to the fact that learning how to tell stories about the future is becoming more urgent and necessary. We actually have a great genre of stories about the future called sci-fi. Right, but people think of them as this, dystopian fiction. Well, I think it's really interesting to think about how can science fiction inform our understanding of what could happen in a more connected way. So great movies like Her, where it talks about, you know, what is it like to actually build a deep relationship with essentially an AI, or Ex Machina, you know, when we can't tell the difference between a robot and a human and that we develop feelings for them. These are really important because I think we're seeing the shrinking gap between science fiction and science fact. I mean, it's happening. And so that is going to be the great divide, I think, of information, is the understanding of just how far advanced we are on some of these technologies.
And is the purpose of these stories to allow us to grapple with those concepts in a more concrete way?
I hope so. I mean, now we're getting more and more of them. I think it was a Black Mirror, and there's a number of them. And I hope they get us into the more important conversations about the moral dilemmas that they pose or the ethical questions. I mean, that's going to hit us fast and furious. And then a big question is, well, who gets to decide? Are the right people in the room deciding? And that is the thing that worries me most. Do people have enough technical baseline and deep philosophical training, critical thinking training, to be able to make the decisions that really are going to affect the future? And we see what happens when people are at vastly different levels of understanding of those issues. I mean, all you have to do is watch the Senate hearings trying to interview Mark Zuckerberg about what happened with, with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. They don't even know how to ask the right questions. So I think we need a more informed governing body for sure, but it's going to happen through the conversations of what they can learn from people on the edge of technology, not just in Silicon Valley, but all over the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting time. So story is a shorthand way not to answer those questions, but to at least open up a conversation, right? To be able to watch something like a Her and say, well, what would happen for that to be true? How close are we to that to be true? I think we're a lot closer than people realize. So it would be much better to talk about it ahead of time, right, than on the other side when it's a catastrophe. I mean, and going back to even an example of how story can really change the debate about, say, policy is, I think, you know, thinking about what Al Gore did with The Inconvenient Truth. For years, he went around with his presentation with just facts and figures and put everyone to sleep. And then he met up with a fantastic group called Duarte Design that turned his facts and figures and urgency around this topic into a compelling narrative called The Documentary of an Inconvenient Truth. Now all of a sudden he's winning Oscars and Nobel Prizes and people are paying attention. Not enough, you could argue, but at least it changed the trajectory of the engagement and the dialogue.
Yeah, I guess I most often will tell myself stories of the future almost just like in my own head as I'm starting out in this career of filmmaking. I think the stories that I tell about the future are ones in my own head where I'm envisioning
right.
what I want my goals to be down the line in this line of work. So I guess I do tell them, but I just had never really framed it that way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting practices around futures thinking I'm just learning about is this method called ethnography of the future. So ethnography is the practice of watching people in the present do what they do, right? Anthropologists look at people in the past to see what they did. But the ethnography of the future is really interesting. How do we envision a future and bring it to life? So there's this incredible project that this woman, Meredith Hutchinson, did with the International Rescue Committee in a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan, where she took these kids and asked them to dress up as their career aspirations. So they dressed up as astronauts and firefighters and scientists, and she took professional pictures of them in these outfits and said, tell me the story of how you got here. Not when I grow up I want to be, but I'm a practicing physician and I help hundreds of people every day. And I got inspired to do this because of all the suffering I saw. And what that did for their sense of agency to envision this future in such a vivid way. And I think the really interesting part of the story is what happened when they were able to take these pictures of them in these outfits and share them with their parents and said, let me tell you why I'm so excited about this future for myself. And in many cases, the parents said, well, we got to keep you in education. Or, you know, in one case, there was someone who was at 10 years old already promised to be married. And they said, well, let's keep you in school. So it can be really powerful if you can bring those futures to life in tangible ways.
That's so cool. All right, well, so we're almost out of time here. So let me think, where do I want to go with the ending of this podcast? Do you have time for two more questions?
We could do two more.
Okay, two more questions. I'm going to jump on this one to, I know you wrote an article about a couple months ago around the concept of empathy.
Yes.
It was around a political event in our country, which was very heated. We don't need to go necessarily into that too much.
Yes.
But empathy is something I think about so much in the work I do. And I'm wondering, just what are your thoughts on empathy in the work that you do and the stories that you tell and what you're trying to bring out for your students?
Yeah. Well, thank you for reading that article. It was an important one to write and to share. And what struck me about that moment in a heated political battle.
We're talking about the Kavanaugh hearing.
All
right, we can just say it.
We can just say it. But I think what struck me on that was how different people heard the different narratives of such extreme different sides. And how one group was so clearly empathizing with Dr. Ford and her story, and another side, many of whom were sitting on the judicial branch listening, you know, to Kavanaugh and how they were able to empathize with him. And so it struck me that for us to really close this increasing divide in the political arena, what would it look like for us to have more empathy for different stories and different perspectives? And I think this practice of empathy, of not just knowing about another, but feeling for another, being for another, is so critical. I mean, if you want to tell a story that resonates, you need to know enough about the audience who's going to see or watch or be a part of the story as about the subject that you're telling the story about, because otherwise it just won't connect, right? It literally won't resonate. So I think empathy is key. I know we share a colleague in our mutual friend Dan Klein, who teaches improvisation at Stanford, and I learned so much from him. One of the most valuable sayings that he has is that, you know, the audience never gets it wrong, right? Like, if you're telling a story and they're not resonating, it's not their fault. You haven't told it in a way that got them to connect with you in the way that you want to, and I think empathy can be a big, big part of that.
And then lastly, for any people out there that are working on a story, maybe it's in their business, a story that they're going to present to an audience, or maybe it's somebody who's writing a story about themselves, maybe they're writing a memoir, whatever it is, and they're a little bit stuck.
Yeah.
On what to do, where to go, how to make the most impact with the story that they're telling. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. Joyful day. And
I like that
usually like just puts off ease.
Yeah,
which
right.
Puts someone in immediately
so much pressure.
Tense pressure. But just tell me about a joyful day.
Yeah.
Gotta allow yourself.
Yeah, if you didn't start and had that whole script ripped up by your editor, then you never would have gotten to where you did.
We never were, you know, or being willing to say, let's
see
where it goes.
Absolutely.
So to be open to it and to
I love that. Before we sign off, where, if people want to learn more about your work, check out your books, where are we sending them?
Great.
Lisa K. Solomon, where are we?
Lisa K. Solomon. Well, that's where you go. You go to lisakaysolomon.com.
Lisa, and then spelled out K-A-Y, correct?
K-A-Y, Solomon, all O's.
All O's. LisaKSolomon.com. I encourage everybody to check her out. And do you have any social media? Are you on that kind of thing?
I'm on that too, at Lisa K. Solomon on Twitter.
At Lisa K. Solomon on Twitter. All right. I think that's it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So fun.
That's it for episode 5 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thanks again to Lisa and to all of you for listening. Thanks to the Sunrunners, Max Cowan and Opus Orange for our theme music today. And a little reflection on this episode for me is while editing this episode, I really enjoyed thinking more about how the 5 strategies for designing impactful conversations can be applied to the stories I tell. Specifically the strategies of starting with the why, engaging multiple perspectives, thinking about framing of the story and how that impacts it, creating a space that fosters my why, and making stories an experience. And I'm pretty sure that if I do that while telling stories about the future, I will make Lisa proud. All right, that's it from me. Remember to check me out on social media at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram and Facebook. Rate, review, subscribe, and I will see you next week. Until then, go out and tell some stories.